It is week 39 of the year 2020, and this is Father Roderick to the Max. Hey, welcome back to the show. This is Father Roderick to the Max, the podcast that I record every week for my supporters, be it on Patreon or also for those of you that are supporting me in different ways. Thank you so much for being part of the community, and welcome if you are listening to this show for the first time. It means that you are a new patron, and I couldn't be more happy to welcome you in the community. Make sure that you figure out how to get on Discord as well. If you've never heard of Discord, then by all means, Google it, because that is also where a lot of the online community gathers and talks to each other. So happy to see you there as well. Well, let's waste no more time and let's get on with the show. And of course, first thing we do, as always, is to head into my kitchen. Despite the fact that I am super busy and I've had a particularly intense week behind me with long days of filming in the southern part of the country, and then another couple of days of full-time editing. And when I say full-time, it means I start at 9 in the morning and I end around 11 o'clock, right at bedtime, and I'm just full-time working. Despite that, I'm happy that I can maintain this regime of cooking every evening. Even yesterday evening, when I was done editing and uploading the whole TV show to the FTP server of the broadcasting company that I work for, even then, at I think it was a 10:15, I was still cooking in the kitchen, despite the fact that I had ordered takeout Chinese. This was part of the Too Good To Go app that I'm using a lot, where you basically save food from going to waste. So it's food that is that can only be sold this particular day, and so if nobody buys it, they have to throw it away. Instead, they put it on an app, and you can come and buy that food for a reduced price. So that's how I get a lot of my ingredients for cooking. But yesterday evening, I was so tired, and I saw this note popping up in my app that there was a Chinese restaurant that had leftover food that they would sell for, I think, $4. And so I was looking on the map, where is this? Okay, it's a little bit far away. It's in a neighboring town, and I have to go there by car. But I was like, okay, I deserve this. I want someone else to cook for me because I worked so hard for days and days and days. I'll give you an update on where I went later on in the show. But so I drove my car. This, and you could only pick it up at 9 o'clock in the evening. So it's a restaurant that is open for, you know, every evening. And so when all the guests are out of the building, then of course they can see what they have left over. And so they put that in a care package and you can pick it up. So this was only $3.99, so it's really dirt cheap. I wasn't expecting much, but I was looking forward to eating, you know, Chinese food, and I was kind of imagining while I was driving there all the, you know, the different types of food that may end up in this magic bag. And so they give me this rectangular package wrapped in paper. That's how they do this. So it was these carton boxes, which actually is the first time in a Chinese restaurant in the Netherlands that I see these. They're very common in North America, where, and I think it's, you know, shouldn't we always use paper carton boxes for this kind of food instead of, here they always use plastic. So every time you go and get Chinese takeout or takeaway, it's always in a number of plastic boxes with plastic lids. It's a huge plastic pollution. And so this restaurant had these carton boxes. The downside is you can't tell what's in there. So they wrapped it in paper, and then they told me to be careful because, you know, it could have sauce in it. So while I'm driving back home, I'm thinking, oh, I hope there is this in it or that or my favorite, you know, Chinese dish. And I arrive home. I'm ravenous. It is 9:30 in the evening. I put it on the table. I open the first box and wah, wah, wah. It is this dark brown mass of meat. And I immediately recognize the type of cuisine. It's not Chinese. It's Indonesian cuisine. It's rendang. So it's this kind of spicy meat that usually it's beef. They let it cook for hours and hours, so it gets really mushy and soft. And it's a little bit sweet, salty. It's nice as one of the ingredients of an Indonesian meal. As you can imagine, the Indonesian cuisine has a lot of variety. That's actually one of the things that many people appreciate of the Indonesian cuisine, is that you get a lot of different stuff if you go to a restaurant. So, and underneath that meat was just plain white rice. You know, like just regular white rice, nothing, no veggies, nothing, no sauce. It was just a thick layer of this brown, mushy meat, and then underneath it was white rice. Like, oh, wow, that's a bit of a disappointment. I was hoping for a Chinese dish. It was noodles or something like that. I was so hungry because I barely ate that day. So I wanted to have noodles. So I was like, okay, two more boxes left. So I opened the second box hoping to find something, you know, different. And after all, there are three boxes. This is from a restaurant. They must have so much different food left over. And then I see exactly the same thing. Only this time the rendang has a slightly, you know, lighter color, so I guess it's a different taste. And then underneath also, which is filled with rice. Like 75% of the box is filled with plain white rice. And then I opened the third box, and it's the same. It's the same. And I was like, oh, man. I'm not going to eat this because it's just the meat itself is also a bit dry. And just with white rice, I can't eat. I mean, in terms of quantity, definitely enough for three meals. So maybe I should not complain for $3.99. But still, I was like, this is not the food that I was hoping for. I was like, okay, what am I going to do? I can eat a sandwich, but I don't want that. I'm just going to go into the kitchen and see if I can upgrade this meal. But at the same time, I'm very grumpy. It's like, I thought I was going to get Chinese food, and instead I got this Indonesian food, and I wasn't in a mood for it, and now I have to upgrade it myself. So anyway, thankfully, I had a lot of veggies in the fridge that needed processing. So I took some cabbage I cut that into very thin slices. I added an onion. I added two garlic cloves. It was like, I don't care. I like, you know, this needs spicy, you know, nice. I added, pepper flakes, the red pepper flakes, to give it a little bit more oomph. I added some... So I put some oil in the pan, started to, just for 30 seconds, put the garlic in, medium fire, of course, otherwise you burn the garlic. I add the onions, I add the cabbage, and I add some oyster sauce. And then I give that a good stir and make sure that it gets nice and aromatic. And then what else did I put in? I didn't add any meat because I thought, well, you know, we've got the rendang meat. That doesn't mix well with Chinese flavors. So I'm just going to skip the meat for now. I did add some, well, of course, I always use some various five spices and a little bit of this and that. Oh, MSG, of course, a bit of MSG. And all that starts to really smell very good, very much my taste. So I add the white rice, mix it all up. And then I plated it after about 10 minutes. And it's just a decent meal. The thing is, it didn't really have... I added mushrooms. I also had a big container of mushrooms that were, you know, on the expiration date. So, and usually mushrooms, at least mushrooms to give you a little bit... That's a good meat substitute in terms of when you eat, it feels like different than just rice and veggies. But on all in all, I was a little bit disappointed. And now I'm like, I'm stuck with two more of those boxes that I need to figure out how to upgrade. But What I like about it is that it challenges me to not be too lazy and to just try to make the best, the most out of what I have as ingredients. And that's actually one of the... Inge is taking a picture of me. I don't know why. She's in the other room doing the administration. But anyway, so what I like is that if you cook with what you have, you're more challenged to come up with creative solutions. So in this case, I didn't have any, you know, proper meat to put in the rice. So I used mushrooms. And I had another mushroom dish that I kind of made up while I was cooking. And also I had a variety. I had a box with a large variety of mushrooms. And not just the regular mushrooms, but also the Italian ones and some of the Chinese shiitake, which normally I would never buy because they're super expensive. But this time it was, you know, basically for almost nothing. And I didn't really know what to do with it. And then I was like, okay, well, what if I make like a nice sauce with chicken breast? So I had some frozen chicken breast. And so I took one out. Defreezed it a little bit in the microwave, not too much, and then I cut it into small pieces and added that, and then I created this nice sauce with the... So first, what did I do first? Of course, first some onions, garlic. I fried the chicken pieces, added some just salt and pepper and paprika powder. So nothing too fancy. And then I added tomato sauce, not really sauce, but the crushed peeled tomatoes. I let that evaporate a little bit. Then I added some stock, just basically a little dried chicken stock and some water. Then I reduced that, and then towards the end, I added cream. So thick cream or whatever you call it. And that really gave it a nice orangey color. And then I put that on some pasta. And all of a sudden I had this wonderful creamy mushroom chicken pasta sauce. And like, oh, I love this. This is great. So fortunately I made enough food for 2 or 3 days. So I still have that in the fridge. So maybe I'll just in the next couple of days, I'll just alternate between the upgraded Indonesian stuff and then the more Italian flavored pasta sauce. And then there's one question that some of you asked me, and that is I posted a photo, I think at one point, with cauliflower rice. And people were wondering, what is that? And this is actually a very low-calorie substitute for rice. Of course, white rice has not much nutritional value. It's a lot of calories. And, of course, I have nothing against it. It's great if you just want to create fried rice, especially if it's a little bit older. But it is not the most nutritious. Brown rice, much, much better. And the thing with white rice is also it's very calorie dense. So if you just want to reduce it a little bit, and I'm currently trying to get a little bit healthier, lose some pounds, I replace it with cauliflower rice. So I buy a full cauliflower, and then I have this KitchenAid small machine that can crush, well, not really crush it, but it's like a small blend, not really a blender. What is it? It's like a kitchen machine, but very tiny. So I put in these florets of the cauliflower, and I give it a stir so that it becomes very crumbly. You have all these cauliflower crumbs. Then I put that in a pan with some oil, and I bake that for a couple of minutes until it shouldn't be completely mushy, of course, like normally you would cook cauliflower, but by frying it with some oil, it does help to get the raw edge of it, but it still keeps a certain consistency. You need actually quite a bit of cauliflower to make a full plate of rice. And then I use that. I always add some salt and pepper and sometimes some garlic powder or whatever to give it some flavor. As long as it's not water, you don't want to add any extra moisture to it because then it doesn't feel like rice anymore. This is also a dish that you can't really mix with a sauce or anything, unless you eat it right away, because the next day it will have absorbed all that moisture and you'll basically just have like mashed cauliflower, which will not have the proper structure. So you have this slightly crumbly fried rice, cauliflower rice, and then you put whatever you've made, for instance, you know, stir-fried veggies and some meat, you put it over it, and you eat it right away. And actually, it doesn't have that particular, that very, you know, recognizable cauliflower scent to it, which when you cook cauliflower, which is, by the way, what the Dutch always like to do. My mom, when she prepared cauliflower, it would always be cooked in water, salted water. And then she would make this cheese sauce, she called it. So it's probably fake cheese. And it was just, so the cauliflower itself was like cooked. And then when you cook it, it has this very, I don't know, strong scent. And it doesn't have any taste because it's just like a bunch of, even cabbage is better tasting, I think. And then you put this cheese sauce over it, so it's basically this thick layer of sauce, but that doesn't really penetrate the cauliflower anymore at this point. So I don't know, it's just like, ooh, as a child, I hated it when we got cauliflower. And so this for me is a much better way to use cauliflower, much tastier, and you get the same amount of, you get all the nutritional value of the cauliflower. And then the other trick to use cauliflower well is to just cut off the upper part of the, you know, make these tiny little, what you call it? You've got the stems of the cauliflower, just like with broccoli. But you only use the upper part, so you don't have that much stem. You can still cut up the stem in small pieces, but and then what I do is I use these very small pieces of cauliflower and broccoli, sometimes even together, and put that in the stir fry. Especially if I'm doing, you know, Chinese type of dish, and then with a little bit, what you could do is to just blanch it, put it in a bit of hot water for just a minute or so. So especially the broccoli gets this very nice green color if you do that, and then you stir fry it. But what you don't want is for cauliflower or broccoli to become mushy and overcooked, because then it just develops this ugly taste. I think that's probably the reason why a lot of kids don't like broccoli, because people just cook the broccoli in salted water and. What good does that do for the dish? It has no taste whatsoever. It may be healthy, but it's not tasty. So that's why I always like to stir fry my cauliflower and my broccoli. That would be my tip for the week. If you have any other suggestions for as to, you know, using cauliflower rice or cauliflower or broccoli, if you have any tips how to upgrade my Indonesian leftover stuff, I'm always open for suggestions. And of course, maybe what I'm going to do is I'm going to open a kitchen on the Discord server. How cool would that be? And that's where we can exchange recipes, because I've got a lot of followers that are into cooking, or at least into eating, aren't we all? And so I think I'm just going to open a Discord kitchen, and that's where we can discuss this segment of the show. Why not? Kitchen, we walk into the chapel. This is the part of the show where I explain some stuff about liturgy, all these rituals and the symbolism that you see in churches, and especially the Catholic tradition, of course. We've got a lot of that stuff, but it's not always explained. People kind of assume that if you go to church, you know how things work, and well,
if you're really honest, probably 90% of the, you know, regular parishioners don't even know what stuff means. But this today, I don't want to talk about the Eucharist or anything like that. I want to talk about baptism as a sacrament. It's, of course, one of the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church. That's where it all starts, right? The baptism was instituted by Jesus himself when he ordered his apostles to go into the world and to baptize everyone in the name of the Father and the Son of the Holy Spirit. And that is what the Christian churches have been doing since the beginning, since the early times of Christianity. And it has always been performed in the same way. For a baptism to be valid and to be the initiation into the community of Christians, you need to do what Jesus asked. And Jesus told his apostles, go and baptize everyone in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. He didn't say you just baptize everyone in the name of Mother Earth and the hope of the rainbow and the sprinkling water or something like that. No, it's Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Because the baptism, what is baptism? Baptism is to become part of the communion that is God himself. We believe in a God that is one God in three persons. They all love each other with the greatest love imaginable because it's divine love. So it far surpasses any form of love and relationship that we know from our human condition. So it's a perfect love of the Father for the Son and of the Son for the Father. That love in itself is a person, is the Holy Spirit. So it is a relationship with the Trinitarian God, with God who revealed himself to be Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And that is why there's been this huge discussion lately because of a document that the Vatican issued saying, well, we got to be really careful on how we administer baptism, the sacrament of baptism. You have to do it the way the Church has been doing it since the very beginning. So it means that the one who baptizes says, I baptize you in the name of the Father and the Son of the Holy Spirit, and then pours water three times over the head of the person who is baptized, or you can also have baptism by immersion. However, that is pretty rare nowadays because most churches don't have a basin or a lake in the back of the church. So, but the form also includes the water. You can't baptize with beer or oil or anything. It has to be just water. And so all these things matter because they have been, this is the way Mandalorians would understand this. This is the way. But it's also, it goes deeper than that because then, of course, a lot of people were complaining, like, why is the Vatican so finicky when it comes to the form of the sacrament? Isn't it all about intention? And as long as people are, you know, well-intentioned, why all the details? And so one of the things that the church, the Vatican said, is that the representative of the church who baptizes should use the formula, I baptize you. And of course, a document like that is not launched by accident. It is because there has been divergent behavior that they want to correct. And what was the situation in the Vatican got wind of that a number of churches, local parishes, well-intentioned priests, I mean, I don't doubt the good intentions of all those involved, but that sometimes a different formula would be used. So they would say, we, the community, the followers of Jesus, baptize you. And the Vatican says that doesn't constitute a baptism. That is invalid. And the same is true for formulas that diverge from the Trinitarian formula. So this has been quite a thing starting in the 60s and then the 70s, where people were unable to distinguish what is consistent throughout liturgy history when it comes to forms and words, what is necessary for the sacrament to be valid, and what is optional, what can be changed. Like in the, of course, I've shared with you how in the 70s, especially the Catholic liturgy has changed quite a bit, and there has been this time of flux where people were trying to figure out, okay, so how are we going to improve the liturgy and reform in a certain way the liturgy? And that, so it's of course understandable that for a certain time in these time when there was change happening, people were trying out stuff. And so one of the this is also the kind of the flower power period culturally. And so it became a thing to come up with your own formulas. You still see this in some areas of the world with wedding vows. So for Catholics, at least in this part of the world, you've got just very specific wedding vows that are prescribed, and you cannot diverge from it. Now, I know that in a lot of other countries, I've seen this also. I've heard this even from Catholics in the U.S. and North America. Let me know on Discord if this is a thing, that it is very common, actually almost a tradition, that the newlyweds or the people that are going to wed, they formulate their own wedding vows, which I think is a bad idea. I mean, again, the intention is well, but do you really at that moment, is this a moment where you just want to, you know, speak from the heart? This is a very formal thing that you do. You vow to stay faithful for the rest of your life in good times, in bad times. And so the church has a formula for that that includes all these aspects of what you are doing. Whereas if you start to come up with stuff yourself, who tells you that you're really formulating what you're actually doing, or will it just be up to how you feel at that moment? I love you with the stars in the skies. I love you a thousand starships and blah blah. You know, people are going to channel the pop songs that they hear, but is that truly what constitutes the sacrament? Now, of course, in wedding liturgy, there are many different aspects. What you basically need for the sacrament to be valid is to have a witness. Because it's actually the people that are wedding, they give each other the sacrament of matrimony. And what is essential is the yes. It has to be a 100% yes to each other. So the form is some aspects, I should say, of the liturgy are less stringent, are less, let's say, defining of the validity of the sacrament than when you compare it, for instance, to the Eucharist or to the sacrament of baptism and confirmation. There you need specific, in a specific form, specific words. And so if someone in the 70s has been baptized in the name of, you know, the Mother, Father, God, the child, follower, Jesus Christ, Rabbi Jesus, and the universal galactic power that we call the Holy Spirit or the breath of life, then that is an invalid baptism. And of course, you've read the news about this priest who discovers on a video, this of course is the newer generation, when I was baptized, there was no way to record that. You couldn't even, you know, tape the audio, because audio was recorded with huge tape recorders. No one had those. And so the only thing that remains is usually a photo. And if you're lucky, a booklet. But even then, in those days, the booklets usually belong to the church. And so I only have a photo of my baptism, and I see a priest that looks like a pretty classic priest, and so I'm pretty sure, and I was also baptized in a very classic Orthodox, well, not Orthodox in terms of Eastern Orthodox, but in a church that was known for its orthodoxy. My parents at the time weren't even going to church. They were pretty much fallen away Catholics, and this was one of the moments for them where they realized that they wanted to raise their child in the Catholic way, and that in order to give a good example, they should also, you know, practice their faith again. So, but all that makes me think that, well, probably my baptism is valid. I don't think that was the type of priest that would go all flower power. But, of course, generation after me, people were recording this on their cell phones. And we also often keep the booklets that were used. And so this priest, who's been priest for many years, discovers, I think on tape, on a VHS tape of his own baptism, right after this document from the Vatican comes out, that the priest uses, "We baptize you." I think that was it. And so, following the stipulations of the Vatican, his baptism is valid. The thing is, in order for all the other sacraments to be, well, valid, to be working, to be legit, the baptism is the beginning. If that is invalid, then you get this domino effect. So it meant, he discovered, that his ordination to the priesthood was invalid. Because you cannot ordain, you can use the words, but it's not magic, right? You can only build upon what has already been started before. So if the baptism is invalid, even though everybody was well-intentioned, and it was definitely at the time the intention of the bishop to ordain a priest, it didn't happen because the matter of the sacraments was lacking. It's like you want to baptize someone, but there's no water. You can use sand and use the best intentions of the world, but it's still not going to be a baptism because the water is essential. And in this case, also, the predisposition has to be, like, if I compare it with a matrimony sacrament, for a wedding, for the sacrament of matrimony to be valid, there has to be a 100% commitment to each other. So if there's one of the parties, one of the people that are partaking, you know, one of the, how do you call that, people that are going to wed, if one of the two is not entirely honest, maybe has a mistress or a mister on the side, and is like, okay, I'll just say the words, but in the meantime, yeah, or even, you know, contemplating the thought, well, we'll see how it goes. Maybe in a couple of years, we'll get fed up with each other, and we'll just separate. Or there may be other invalidating circumstances. Like one of the two may think, well, yes, I want to marry her, but no kids. Absolutely not. We're not open to life. That's not going to happen. That's another reason for the sacrament to be invalid. Because the necessary ingredients, like you cannot cook noodles without noodles, right? So sacraments is the same thing. There have to be some ingredients that have always been part of the sacrament. And without it, you don't have a sacrament, no matter the intentions. So that was the case with this ordination as well. So what happened was that he was rebaptized, or, well, actually baptized for the first time. And then he received all the other sacraments again. So, for instance, of course, you have the Eucharist. Of course, he had already received communion. That doesn't change the validity of the Eucharist. It's just the legitimacy of him receiving communion as a non-baptized person. But then again, he wasn't aware of that, so he can't really. That's not a sin. It's just unfortunate. So, but anyway, so he was ordained. And so now he's a new priest. It's insane. And that had tremendous consequences for the sacraments that he administered as basically a fake priest. Or, well, he wasn't faking it, but he wasn't a real priest. So some sacraments, as a result of that, become also invalid. Not all of them, though. For instance, baptism. The baptisms that he administered were maybe illicit. That's the legal term that the canon law uses, so illicit, but they were valid, especially if you use just a regular form of baptism, no doubt about that. Obviously, confession, not valid. It does not mean, by the way, that people weren't forgiven, because for the forgiveness to take place, you just need to have full remorse, complete, perfect remorse. That constitutes enough to be forgiven. However, the sacrament in itself is still invalid. So then if he would have been, imagine that he would have been consecrated a bishop, and he would consecrate other priests, and all those ordinations would be invalid. Oh my gosh. So words matter. And of course, it was a lot of pushback in some circles against this. So why is the Vatican so nitpicky? Isn't God bigger than that? Yeah, well, of course he is. Of course God is greater than his sacraments. However, he wanted to. Jesus wanted his church to have the sacraments. He orders it specifically. So who are we to think, well, you know, it's optional. You can just, eh. Of course, baptism is, yeah, it's a nice ritual, but I'll just leave it up to God. That is not what Jesus did. He didn't just say, well, just you go and baptize people in the name of the Father and the Holy Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, or you just do a little dance with flowers and rose petals and sing a nice song. It's up to you. You just whatever floats your boat. That is not really what Jesus did. So we are followers as Christians of Jesus. So we try to do what he did. We take that seriously. Do this in memory of me, says at the Last Supper. That is why we have the Eucharist. Do this in memory of me. 2,000 years in uninterrupted tradition. Using the same words, the same matter. We don't use banana bread and beer. We use bread, unleavened bread and wine. Very important. If you change the matter, the sacrament becomes invalid. If you change the consecration words, it becomes invalid. If you change anything else in the liturgy, it becomes fishy, and you have to really take a look at, was this, you know, is this valid or not? Anyway, the real reason for this is, of course, we do what Jesus did. We follow his. He did not tell us, he did not give us permission to make up our own formula for baptism. He told them, this is how you do it. And then the I baptize you instead of we is also essential. Because in baptism, it's not the community that baptizes, it's Christ who embraces you. It's the person who baptizes is representing Christ who embraces this person. And so the if you say, well, we baptize you, it's almost as kind of a more Protestant church view. It's like, well, so it's we, the community, that baptizes you. So it is, the baptism itself is not based on Christ embracing you as a person who wants to be baptized, but it is, so it's, it now depends on the community. So it creates this confused ritual where, so is baptism just membership of the community? No, it's much more than that. It is a personal, eternal bond with Christ. And so that is why in the sacraments there is this singular formula. If you change it to we, you change basically the meaning of what you're doing and the intention also of what you're doing. So that is very, very tricky business when it comes to the sacraments. And of course, as I explained earlier on, the consequences are massive, absolutely massive. Hey, let's switch back to things that I learned online. Just a very quick tip. As I told you before, I've been super busy, right, with filming. So I went a couple of days ago, went to the south of the country. No, first I took my bike to go film in a location about an hour. Yeah, it was on paper, it was an hour by bike. Now, the format of the TV show is that I'm traveling through the Netherlands by bike. Corona times, you don't want to be the car, don't want to use public transport. Bike is safe and also makes for very nice outdoor shots. However, if I have to film in the south of the country, of course, I need some help. So I take the bike with me. I go there by car, and then during the day itself of shooting, I ride my bike. So the first day I went, I was like, okay, this is only an hour on Google Maps, so I'm just going to take my bike for real. And then I forgot that this was actually in a very hilly area. So, whoa, and I'm really not a trained biker. I don't ride my bike that often. I'm a runner. I'm a walker. And I discovered the painful way that riding a bike requires some different sets of muscle. So I suffered a little bit. Anyway, I filmed that entire day. And then the next day, I went to film two episodes in the south of the country. So I went to an outdoor museum where in the, I think it was around 1918, they recreated what at the time was the perception of what the Holy Land would have looked like. So this was a an assistant priest. He was like, okay, well, I really would like my parishioners to be able to visit the Holy Land, but back then, a century ago, that was not really within reach of almost anyone. So he's like, well, let's build it here. Let's just do a replica. And that museum has been around for about a century. And of course, as you can imagine, in a country, in a Europe that is so secularized now, the target audience of the museum has slowly disappeared. And now they're stuck with all these buildings, and they're not even historical buildings. They're based on kind of this, what they called Orientalism at the time. It was kind of this this trend to everything that came from the East was exotic. And a lot of the buildings that you see there, for instance, they have buildings that represent the House of St. Joseph, the House of Mary. They built like a Roman quarters with the palace of Pontius Pilate. All that is not really based on historical evidence or anything. It's just what is based on a romanticized idea of the Middle East and of Israel. But anyway, it's still very special, and it still tries to tell a good story. So I was like, okay, that's definitely in the area where I'm currently supposed to be with my show, so I'm just going to visit that. Well, because Corona has almost killed that museum. They're in huge financial distress. They hardly had any visitors for months, and they were already on a shoestring budget. And it's a massive property. So anyway, it's fascinating, but also a little bit sad. Because you're walking around there and it almost looks like a ghost town. And all these buildings are just not maintained very well. There's no money for that. They used to have all sorts of cosplayers, you know, people that were dressed up like, I don't know, people from the Holy Land. They all were all fired. They don't have any money for that. So what remains is just something that looks like a 1930s film set. And so I went there with the current guy who's in charge, which, by the way, told me that he was agnostic. I was like, say again? Okay, so you're running this formerly biblical museum, and you're agnostic? And he didn't know much. Well, of course he knew the property, but it was just been appointed for about 2 months. But I was like, okay, but that doesn't make sense. If you want to be creative about the future, you still need to take into account what you have and understand from the inside. So I had a couple of ideas about how you could maybe make that work. And to me, it's all about storytelling. You have to tell these stories instead of just using it as an old-fashioned museum. It doesn't have any, you know, educational value, but it does have a tremendous storytelling potential. But then you have to completely rethink this concept. Anyway, so I was super triggered, but also at the end of the day, completely exhausted of all the bouncing balls in my head and then having to film there. And it was a huge property. So I walked miles and miles and miles to film everything. Then the day after that, I went to Elphia in the south of the country. It's one of the few events that actually was able to take place with lots of measures, of course, social distancing, but I was so glad that this fantasy event took place. It's the only one that I know, and it's still for me an opportunity to meet my friends. And so I stayed in a bed and breakfast for a night, and also filmed a documentary about the bed and breakfast, because this is run by a family, three generations, but they also form a religious community. So they have a chapel. They have adoration every day. They pray for their guests in a bed and breakfast. So it was cool and really wonderful to be there to film that story. But then I also went to Elphia, walked around, and a little bit, I mean, I love being there. It was a wonderful day. The costumes were out of this world beautiful. At the same time, there were still a lot of moments during that day that I felt that it was too crowded or people just didn't keep enough distance. So the next day I developed a cough and I was like, I'm going to die. Oh, no, I have COVID-19. You know, I'm a little bit hypochondriac. Well, I'm still alive. It's now a couple of days later. I think I'm fine. This is probably just a common cold. But I was really, for a couple of days, like, oh no, please don't tell me that I got infected. So in hindsight, was it entirely safe? Maybe not. And the situation in the Netherlands is getting worse. There are some areas. My area, this region around Utrecht, is also now, by many countries in Europe, is being labeled as a red area. So very dangerous. I think we're heading for a second. We're already at the start of a new second wave. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a few weeks from now, if you look at the way this virus is spreading, we'll probably have to go into a lockdown again. So bracing myself. And at the same time, it's like, oh, thank God I was able to go to Elfia and to just have this one moment of the year where everything feels like how I want the world to be. I want the world to be this fairy tale. It is not, but escapism sometimes is just what I need to keep the engine running. Anyway, long story to tell you about something that I noticed. Since I'm doing so much stuff, I always have these ideas, and I never know where to put those ideas. So I used to have Evernote, which was absolutely fantastic, but then they switched to a paid model and it became a little bit too expensive. So I switched to OneNote. OneNote is great. I love it. For a free app, amazing. I do everything in OneNote. But it's a little bit clunky, especially on mobile devices. You always have to be logged in. For some reason, the app, at least the app on my old iPhone, kept logging me out. So it's really tough to just make a quick note. Same is true on my computer. So I sometimes put it in OneNote in a document, then I can't find it. Or when I'm on the road, for instance, when I'm filming, I need to have the names of the people that I interview, especially if they're, you know, impromptu interviews. So I always jot down the names. Where do I put those? Usually I send myself an email, which is the clunkiest method possible. And then just recently in YouTube, I see this tutorial, which is like, oh, that is so cool. It is the Sticky Notes app. Sticky Notes, we all had them, you know, these post-its, these multicolored notes. I think even Apple had an implementation of that, like a digital version of that. Sticky Notes are amazing. And there's so much like the way I think. Like I have an idea. I put it on a piece of paper and then I know where it is. I just put it on my desktop or whatever. And then later on, I can take the info from the sticky notes and put it into a document or into a plan. Turns out that OneNote has sticky notes integrated. And on the PC, on Windows, it is even a separate app. And it creates a sticky note. It is so intuitive and it's so cool. The big difference, of course, with real sticky notes is they're all synced in the cloud. So you can use it wherever you are. It is amazing. In the the Android phones, at least, and I suppose the same for iOS, it is integrated in the OneNote app. So I still need to figure out where that is and how I can quickly create a new sticky note. But this is a game changer for me. This is such a great place for me to dump my ideas, even better than OneNote or Evernote used to be. And then I would just put it in a paper and then, or a note, and all these notes are in a hierarchy. And before I find it back, it takes forever. But sticky notes, it's for short-term stuff. Jot down a quick note or a telephone number or anything. Just being able to do that. And of course, I would love to be able to really write on my phone or on an iPad or whatever, on a tablet. That would make it even cooler, but we're not there yet. Speaking of which, it's time to talk tech. Do I have a jingle for tech? I don't even know. I don't dare to push because I'm constantly pressing the wrong buttons here lately. I'm just going to take a look on my Rodecaster if I have. I can do Geek Week. Geek Week. I don't know what this is. I'm just going to press this button. This is comic books, right?
I'm comic books.
I don't want to talk about comic books. So it's not even... Oh, boy. Okay, what is this? Oh, just a little song. Okay, I'll just use this. A little bit of music. So anyway, I want to talk a bit about technology. And I've got a number of things that I wanted to say. First of all, quick
Okay, that's enough music for now.
A quick recap of the Apple event and then the Oculus event, or now it's called Facebook VR or something like that. They totally ditched the name Oculus. What is cool is that these two events are from two major players, Apple and Facebook. But the difference couldn't be bigger. And especially now that we don't have these live presentations anymore of Apple events, everything is filmed in advance in their new circular donut building. And it all looks so boring. It's filmed meticulously well. It is so well done. But man, is it sleep-inducing. There's something about their style. It's too clean. It's there's no life in it. Audiences are very important for, I think, for the Apple communication. And I understand that they can't do it. They don't want to risk it. But it misses that interactivity. And everything is just too slick. It just doesn't work. What is also, I think, a big problem with Apple, with this Apple event, and I don't know about you, but I thought it was the most uninspiring thing I've ever seen. It was just, oh, we did an upgrade of our watch. And now we have two watches. There are three watches. One is expensive and has, I don't know, like two or three. I don't even remember what was new. It was so, I think like blood oxygen or something like that. It looked like, okay, well, doesn't really make me too excited. And then they had, like they have the, what is it, the previous model? And then they have the three and I don't know. But they took like 20 minutes to show us that. Then they had the iPad. They didn't show any. It was just a footnote that there was a new iOS 14, which I can't run on my iPad anymore. But anyway, they just mentioned it. Oh, yeah. By the way, tomorrow, iOS 14. So no demo of the software. Just a demo of the iPad Air, which is just an iPad Pro 11-inch. It's a slightly, slightly different thing. It's cheaper. Yes, it's still $599. I think it's €650. I still think it's a little bit expensive for something that has the basically the shape of a regular iPad. And then they still keep the old format with the like their cheapest iPad is still this old-fashioned thing, which I think they should have ditched 3 years ago. But anyway, again, the iPad Air is now more powerful in many many ways than their iPad Pro, but there were no iPad Pros. I was like, and then it's just, there's nothing, really nothing new about the iPad Air. It's just a little bit cheaper, and I don't know, mimics an iPad Pro. I was like, ugh, wake me up when this is over. There were no surprises. At least I thought there was nothing. Nothing to hold my interest, and yet I was watching this for 2 hours, and at the end it was like, oh, most disappointing Apple event ever. And then I think it was the next day or something like that, Facebook does their Oculus event. It's a yearly event. Oh my goodness, I was like, I'm watching the future. This is so cool. How did I not know about this? So I couldn't watch everything because I think I had to do work. I don't know. I was like, I need to watch this back. It was so exciting. There were so many ideas. There was even this guy who was like in charge of the software of the VR, of the Oculus Quest. And he was just having like an open conversation, like a brain dump. And it was like, oh, wow, this is the kind of stuff that makes it feel real. These people are really looking for innovation. And of course it's Facebook. Tons and tons of yes, but in my mind, it was like, cool, but it's still Facebook. Are you guys really, you know, keeping the morality of what you do in mind? But anyway, it's so full of innovation, and there was so much to discover, and I got so excited about the technology, what they were projecting. Like, of course, they launched the Quest 2, which is cheaper and in many respects better than the original Oculus Quest. It is going to be their go-to device. I'm super excited about that. You can hook it up to your PC, and they're going to stop the Rift. Now, of course, there are also downsides to that. But anyway, it means that it's going to be the standard. And this technology needs standardization for to be embraced. So I, for my part, am super excited about where Facebook is taking the Oculus. But they were also showing kind of the near future and what they were working on in terms of AR and how they were gathering information and what that could mean for the way that we interact. And the coolest presentation was this, where they presented their VR glasses or their AR glasses, which for me was totally new. It was like, oh, so Facebook is also working on this, and they're trying even to be faster than Apple, because we all know that Apple is working on AR glasses. It just takes them forever. They could just keep doing these minor iterations instead of delivering something. You know, there's one more thing. It's been years since we heard something that was truly innovative from Apple. I'm sorry, Apple fanboys. I'm one of them. But Apple is dropping the ball on innovation. They may be working behind the scenes, but what good is it for a cook to cook something and he's constantly peeking around the corner and telling the guests in the restaurant, oh, I'm just working on the most amazing dish. Yeah, but it's not going to be tonight. It's going to be maybe next week, and then you come next week. Oh, I've got an upgraded pasta penne, but, you know, and you really should try my dessert. It's slightly, you know, there's now slightly more chocolate on it. But that dish that I was talking about, that amazing dish that will completely, you know, make you feel like you're in heaven, it's, we're working on it, and I think we're really going to make a great dish next week. How long do you think these guests are going to stay with that restaurant? I don't know if Apple can. But anyway, so I'm getting lost in my metaphors. Facebook, the way they were presenting their AR glasses, but especially what they said, you know, they've showed videos of people looking at their phone. It's one of the things that I think is, this is not going to be our future. All these people staring at their phones, interrupting any social communication, like when you're in a restaurant or in a company, how many people are just looking at their phones instead of partaking in a regular conversation? This presentation said, this is not going to be the future. What if you could access information and interact with other people while at the same time being still part of the environment, not getting lost staring at this small device in your hand? What if this could all be in your glasses? And then they showed us this prototype, and I was like, okay, they asked the right questions. I'm not sure if Facebook has the right solution and if we're all going to like it, but they definitely are onto something, and they are, I think, doing a great job involving their future audiences and their community into the process of preparing this future. And they're trying to build, there was much more attention being paid to privacy and all those, you know, ethical aspects of what they do. And to me, that was believable. And maybe that's me being naive, but this is the kind of presentation that gets me super excited about the potential of this technology. And that was the big difference between Apple and Facebook. Then we had another presentation, tech-related, and that was Microsoft presented its new Xbox, the Xbox Series S, Series X, two models, one $499, it's the big guns, and then what surprised me, very affordable $299 version, which is purely digital, so you can't use it to run discs, but it runs every new game. And then in combination, I've got the Game Pass Ultimate. You will immediately have the best version of that game. So I'm very excited about that. This is also a new element in the consideration, I'm still pondering about it, about the tablet that I want to buy. Huge avalanche of good arguments from all of you why I should go for the iPad and not for an Android-based tablet. And they're all very valid. But Apple is a closed system, as you all know. And so there will be no cloud gaming on the Apple unless every game is going to be posted individually in the App Store. I think it's a ridiculous proposition. And unfair also, because when I start my Kindle app, I have got all my books. Not every book has to be its own entry. So Apple is just, I think, playing games to, you know, keep to protect their closed garden. I don't like it. It is just the way Apple has been behaving for years now. I just don't like that. I don't like to be imprisoned, even if it's the most wonderful iPad. But the thing is, the Xbox has an app for Android that allows you to play any game that you have in the Game Pass Ultimate on the tablet. That instantly adds huge value to the, you know, the Android version, your Android option. And that is not just true for this. It's also true of a number of other apps that are not allowed in the App Store, in the Apple App Store, because Apple, closed garden, walled garden, and which is something that you can do on your Android. And just yesterday, the Tab S 7 Plus was discounted, and probably it's even, right now, it's about $200 or $300 cheaper than the iPad. And it's probably going to go down in price quite a bit in the months to come. That's never going to happen to the iPad. Those are very, you know, and that's good for, you know, if you ever want to sell it again on eBay. But I'm just waiting for these Android tablets to go down in price. And yes, maybe they will last a little less, just a few years. But it will give me, that's just like my Android phone. I don't think I'm going to go back to the iPhone anytime soon, because with my Android phone, I feel so much more free, and it's so much more powerful because of what I can run on it. And I can't do that on an iPhone. I can't do it on an iPad. iPad is great if you like what you have. And I love what I have. I love my iPad. It's not that. It's just that, like, there is stuff that I don't think Apple will allow me to do on the iPad that is already available on the Android. That, to me, counts towards the value that that device has for me, even though it may not last as long as an iPad. Or the build quality may be a little bit less. But, you know, this is kind of... I would love to play Xbox games on a tablet. I can't do that on an iPad anytime soon. I can do it on an Android tablet. Okay, just sharing my thoughts here. Join me on Discord to try to convince me of of something else. Hey, then I finally got my Xiaomi Mi Band 5. It's a very, very cheap Fitbit-like band, fitness band. I use it all the time. I never thought I would be using this so often. I count my steps, counts my heart rate day and night, and measures my sleep. It does so many things. And the coolest thing is, it lasts for 14 days, sometimes even more than 14 days, without recharging. And the second best thing is, I only pay $25 for it. And it is amazing. The only thing that I don't like about it is, and that's probably also because of my wrist, I've got very, very small wrists. So in order to make this fit, I have to tighten it around my arm. And then towards in the evening, I can see the imprint of the holes of the band on my wrist. It's like a temporary tattoo, and it looks kind of scary. So that's the only thing. But right now, it's giving me a reminder that I have to drink water. I can program it. It's very cool. It doesn't have GPS. That's another downside. I have to carry my phone with me. It does an approximation, just like the early iWatches or Apple Watches did, but it's not very dependable. So, but anyway, I'm not complaining. And it really, in combination with my smart scales, it really is super motivational for me to try to get my steps in and to improve my BMI and all that. So it makes me much more aware of what's going on. Even the sleep tracking is pretty good. It shows me when I was awake. It shows me how long I slept. It also, you can use other apps. So I'm using a specific app, which is called Notes and Notifications. And it's much more powerful than the proper app. Notify and Fitness for the Mi Band. And then I also use Sync My Tracks on Android to upload this information to Strava, Google Fit, a Runkeeper. It even communicates with Fitbit. Not always, but I've had a Fitbit for years and I still have that account. So now I'm able to sync my steps from this very, you know, simple little band to my old Fitbit account. I just love it. I love it. It's a great, great purchase. And then finally, I'm also contemplating. I'm mesmerized by a very, very cool new Sony camera, mirrorless camera, the A7S III. That's all I'm going to say about it. It is $5,000. It's so expensive, but whoa. Now that I'm filming again and I'm editing everything, I'm so sometimes struggling so much with what the Canon M50 can do. I mean, it's a very, very good deal. It doesn't cost much, and it is enough for TV quality, but I'm also, because I'm getting better and better at filming, my demands on the M50 are sometimes surpassing its capabilities. And so, that A7S III looks enticing. However, super expensive. All right, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. I may have had some other things that I wanted to talk about. We'll have to wait till next week. Thanks for being a patron. Thanks for your support. It means the world to me.